All right, here we go. Quiet!
Quiet! Quiet!
Roll them!
Hello and welcome to the Big Picture Podcast, where we take a look at the latest movie news, the films of today and yesterday, and put it into some sort of context. Seated across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online Editor-in-Chief Rich Dries.
And seated across the microphone from me is Film Buff Online Contributing Writer Natasha Bogitsky. How's it going, Natasha?
Oh, it is going great. We have a lot to delve into this week, so let's get started.
Let's dive in.
Captain Marvel casting.
Yes. Marvel made an announcement this week that they have begun production on Captain Marvel, which is going to star Brie Larson. And, well, we sort of knew that it was already in production because we've been seeing set photos for the last couple of weeks showing Brie Larson in her costume and everything. So that part wasn't too much of a surprise. However, there was a few surprises hidden inside their official announcements in terms of casting, I believe.
Yes, there was. Jude Law had joined the cast as the film's antagonist. But this week it was released that Samuel L. Jackson would be back to reprise his role as Nick Fury. Mm-hmm. We also have Lee Pace joining the cast as Ronan the Accuser, last saw in Guardians of the Galaxy. And a very, very welcome, a hearty, hard welcome back to the MCU of Phil Coulson.
Yay! Agent Coulson of S.H.I.E.L.D.
Yes.
Now, I know you're probably sitting there thinking, wait a minute, didn't they say the TV shows couldn't cross over with the movies because of lead times and logistics and blah, 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 which is really just cover for the fact that the TV side and the film side have two different reporting structures, and the people at the top of those individual chains aren't really friends with each other? Well, yeah, they can't. But here's the hitch. Captain Marvel is taking place in the 1990s, before Phil Coulson, quote-unquote, died in the first Avengers movie and then was subsequently resurrected for the Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. TV show.
Wait, hang on. Does that mean that they are going to age down Agent Coulson back at least 20 years?
Honestly, I think Clark Gregg has always looked that age. I mean, if you... Mm-hmm. Do you remember when he was on The West Wing?
Yeah.
As an FBI agent?
Yes, I do, actually. And I've watched that episode many times.
And I, in my personal headcanon, that FBI agent changes his name to Phil Coulson when he's recruited by S.H.I.E.L.D. That's just my headcanon. I like it. I want to know that in the Marvel Cinematic Universe, President Bartlett was a thing. That's just me.
Yeah, but didn't we have Bradley Whitford's character in a one-shot?
Yeah, Bradley Whitford was in a one-shot, I believe.
Wasn't it in the 40s?
Yeah, so
how do you explain
maybe
that? Grandfather?
It was his character on West Wing's grandfather, yes.
Oh,
it was Josh's
grandfather.
Was it Josh's character?
Josh,
yeah,
Lyman.
Josh
couldn't remember the
character's name. Yeah. So, yeah, so... Personal headcanon.
Oh, my God.
And
what are we doing here?
And Abed from Greendale Community College went on to also work at S.H.I.E.L.D., but that's a whole nother thing.
Oh, God.
Anyways, so that's the kind of loophole that they're using to bring back Clark Gregg to the cinematic fold, as well as bringing in Lee Pace, playing once again Ronan the Accuser, because as we all who have seen Guardians of the Galaxy know, he didn't quite survive to the end credits in that movie, did he?
No.
He lost the dance off.
Yeah.
And that also means another Guardians of the Galaxy actor will be making an appearance too in Captain Marvel. That's Digimon Honsois, if I'm pronouncing that correctly. And
we're probably both butchering it. I've always called him Jaimin Hanunsu.
Okay.
But I'm pretty certain I'm butchering it as well.
So. Maybe a little column A, a little column B there.
It's like Saoirse Ronan. It took me a while to learn that one,
I know,
too.
I know.
Sorry.
But it's nice to see that, you know, we knew Captain Marvel was going to take place at least partly in outer space, out in the cosmic side of the cinematic universe. So it's nice to see that they're going to tie in a couple of characters there. Are there going to be any other ones that we'll get to see? Who knows?
Hey. Okay. Well, here's storyline-wise. If Captain Marvel is taking place in the 90s, what the hell has she been doing for the past 20 years while the world almost died in New York and then in Sokovia? What, has she been sitting on her fingers dilly-dallying this entire time?
It's possible. She might be... We'll find out, I guess, in the film. You know, I'm sure they'll leave it open for sequels, but we'll find out. Maybe she's just out in the galaxy doing galaxy superhero stuff. And at some point, you know, we're probably going to see her in Avengers 4. It feels really obvious. They've all been saying, oh, she's not in Avengers Infinity War. But the next one that we'll get, not in a couple of weeks, but a year from now, I feel we'll probably be seeing her there.
Probably. Yeah.
You know, this movie, you know, her solo film sets her up for that. And then whatever happens at the end of it. Actually, you know, we might even have a better idea of when we'll be seeing her or how she fits in at the end of this Avengers movie, I think, even. I think we'll have like a clue or two. Maybe she like makes a quick, you know, cameo appearance right at the end saying, hey, guys, let's get together and do this now or something. And then they use the next movie as the flashback to, oh, here's who that person was who just showed up at the end of whatever.
I'm just happy we're getting more 90s.
Okay.
I'm nostalgic for the 90s.
Well, we're going to talk about nostalgia when we get to our main film review later in the podcast.
But come on, how awesome would it be to see Brie Larson walking down the street, just kind of with her Walkman on?
Totally 90s, ripped up jeans, wearing some plaid.
Wait. Are we doing early 90s or are we doing late 90s? Because I'm a fan of the later 90s.
I'm a middle 90s guy when we had the swing revival, but that's
okay. Okay. Just not the crazy Will Smith colors from Fresh Prince.
No.
I love the show. I love the song. No one needs the fashion.
True. But we also have some other superhero news I think you're particularly excited about.
Yes. Continuing on with casting, let's go from the Marvel Cinematic Universe to the DC Extended Universe. Pedro Pascal has been cast in the new Wonder Woman sequel.
Wonder Woman 2, I believe it's being called.
I'm trying to avoid the abbreviation of Pedro Pascal in WW2.
Well, you know, the movie's set in the 80s, not the 40s. So.
Yeah.
So again, another superheroine movie being set in a previous decade.
Well, it worked for the first Wonder Woman. Why not see if we can do that magic again?
True.
Although the 80s?
Cold War era? 80s, you got a lot of intrigue with the Russians, the Soviet Union at that time. There's a lot, I think there's some interesting geopolitical stuff at play that you could work with there. Similar to how World War I, the world was at war and Ares took advantage of that. I don't particularly want to see the return of Ares, but there's some stuff that could be going on there that I think...
Yeah, but they messed around with the last great war. That's kind it's a war. That's a moment where she should be in play, definitely. Mm-hmm. But given how she was in Batman versus Superman or how she was leading up to Justice League, she hadn't dealt with her past of what happened in the first Wonder Woman. This is taking place in between there. She's still not there yet. There's no way in hell she'd be sticking her nose in where it doesn't belong unless it was absolutely necessary.
True.
Cold War doesn't seem like the perfect fit for that.
Well, we got close to nuclear annihilation a couple of times that we know of, mostly with the Cuban Missile Crisis was probably the closest.
That was the 60s.
Yeah, and that's the 60s, though. So, you know, obviously they haven't sent me a copy of the script yet to read, so I can't... I can't tell you exactly what they're thinking there. I mean, there's a lot of things they could be doing in there. Even the late 80s when the Berlin Wall came down, you know, you could do something there or something that leads up to, you know, in the DC movie universe, some other events that she partakes in that eventually lead to the breaking down of the Berlin Wall. although I can almost see it as like she's in a fight with somebody and she goes flying through the wall, and that's the keynote thing, which would be a terrible idea.
Don't write that in.
No.
Writers, do not write that in. That's not that's not a good thing.
No, not at all.
At least Atomic Blonde did it well.
That's true. Atomic Blonde had fun with it.
Yeah.
I just think at some point they really have to start explaining, and I think actually we can just reject what they say about her in Batman v Superman, where she was just like, after World War One, I was like, ick, war, and I hid for a while. I don't like that for the character, especially the way they leave her at the end of the first Wonder Woman movie. They really do kind of have to explain her non-public appearances over the next century, really, for that to kind of really gel. But then again, there's a lot of things that are wrong with the DC cinematic universe.
That's a whole other podcast.
Yeah, and this is one of the least of the problems there.
Yeah.
And speaking of problems, it seems Steven Spielberg has a problem with Netflix movies.
He wouldn't be the first director to come out and view of this.
True, but he is certainly probably the most prolific of the directors who have come out and said this, basically, that he doesn't feel that movies that appear on Netflix aren't real movies. If they're made for Netflix and only got like a token theatrical run in New York and Los Angeles, that they're not real movies, they shouldn't be eligible for consideration for the Oscars. And
at most, the Emmys, he said.
Yeah.
Because they're version of a TV movie.
Mm-hmm. Which I'm kind of, as I think about it more and more, you know, the last couple of days, I think he's painting with a rather broad brush. It's kind of a shitty statement coming from him, too, because he started his career doing TV movies. His first couple of jobs were the 2-hour pilot TV movie for Rod Serling's Night Gallery, and his first movie, Duel, which basically it's like Jaws with cars, was also a TV movie, but it was shown theatrically in Europe. So it was on a lot of screens in Europe, but it was shown on TV here. So is it a TV movie or is it a movie? And he said, once you make that decision to, you know, that it's going to be for a service that appears on your TV, it becomes a TV movie automatically. And so, okay, maybe Duel was a TV movie that just got a theatrical release over in Europe.
I don't think he really craps on the idea of TV movies.
No, he's not crapping on them so much, but I think...
But I...
his statement's a little too broad what Netflix does.
True. What would Duel have even been in the running for any awards, if it could have been at the time?
Honestly, I don't know if it was up for anything. I recall it being, you know, I haven't seen it in a good long time, but I recall it being a well-constructed film. So it's hard for me to, you know, just say, well, it should have been an Oscar contender anyways, no matter what, because it showed in Europe or anything. And I do agree with him. At some point, you know, if you're shooting something for, specifically for television, you are going to make certain artistic choices, whether it be in terms of framing or lighting or anything, that will possibly be different from the artistic choices you would be making if you were shooting the exact same material for a big screen. The problem is TV has evolved so much that I'm just looking at my television screen right now, and it's the same basic aspect ratio as the movie screen we just saw Ready Player One on a couple of hours ago. So for me, at this point, there's not much of a difference in terms of what is being delivered. It's just the delivery method.
I think that's what he's trying to get across. He doesn't have a problem with the format of television or cinema. He's a little worried about the delivery method and how that's going to affect filmgoers.
True.
Are they going to be more liable to stay home on a Friday night and say, oh, let's turn on Netflix because this film dropped, instead of going to the movie theater to see something that was either hard worked on or even more so hard fought for?
True.
Because a lot of independent filmmakers, particularly, they have to fight in order to get some sort of release for their films. If they are just coming straight to Netflix, yes, it's an easy delivery method. But you and I discussed this a few weeks ago. Netflix clogs up with so much material that you can easily miss some of the best works out there.
True.
Whereas a theater puts them first and foremost.
Okay. Now, I just want to, you know, put a little historical spin on the first part of what you said, whereas there's the push and pull between, do we stay at home and watch Netflix and chill, or do we go to the movie theater and spend a lot more money?
You and I believe in Netflix and chill as being something completely different than what the rest of society says.
Yes, I know.
We had to clarify that point.
Well, hey.
Netflix and chill for us is actually, we sit on the couch and we do nothing but watch Netflix.
And eat ice cream.
Yes. Well, maybe not ice cream.
And but it's just a variation of back in the 50s when television first started to sweep across the nation, and everybody was buying a television and everybody had a television in their living room, and suddenly movie theaters saw a sharp decline in attendance over a couple of years very quickly, and they're like, what's going on? Oh, people are getting movies and other things directly in their home that they don't really have to pay for, as long as they don't mind sitting through a couple of commercials. So that's where the movie theater suddenly started to have to innovate, and that's where they developed widescreen, because that's a different shape than your square TV. And they developed 3D, and then they, you know, into the 60s and early 70s, they developed stereo and then surround sound and all that. And now we just have where home theaters have kind of caught up to that. So you can sit at home with your 72-inch widescreen TV, watch something that's digitally delivered, that looks crisp and clear, in 4K, even if you have, you know, upgrade to that kind of Blu-ray player, a nice surround system in your own home. This is all, you can do this in the comfort of your home. You don't have to fight through traffic to get to a theater. You don't have to put up with idiot kids sitting behind you, you know, eating, talking, and throwing their popcorn around at each other through a movie. That sounded a little specific tonight, for tonight.
Yeah,
didn't it?
It was. don't forget about the overpriced concessions.
Well, yeah. Well, I give the concessions a slide because that's where the theater chains make their money. Yeah, they don't make it at the box office because of the ticketing split. And I think we all are, you know, familiar with how that works.
Yeah.
So, you know, and some people are just, you know, like, I don't want to go to the theater anymore. You and I, and hopefully I would think a lot of our listeners are fans of the theatrical experience, being in that darkened room with friends and strangers and all experiencing the same thing at once. Everybody, or hopefully everybody, laughing or being emotionally touched in the same way at the same time. It's a very special thing. But for a lot of people, it's not that. So you're seeing ticket prices are at their highest they've ever been, because that's how inflation works over time. But, you know, movie going attendance, I think, has taken a little bit of a dip again. But you're still going to see, you know, movies that break $1 billion at the box office, like Black Panther, like Avengers Infinity War will, unlike, you know, very likely do in a couple of weeks from now. You know, you have that.
I'm pretty certain MoviePass helps out as well.
Well, yeah, there's been some reportage where back over the winter, MoviePass released some figures that said, hey, it looks like MoviePass customers have helped the box office for smaller independent films like Lady Bird or Shape of Water, much more so than they did help the box office for Last Jedi or, you know, something along those lines. Simply because I'm paying $10 a month, I've probably already seen one of the bigger films anyways, so I've gotten my $10 out of MoviePass. Everything else I see is basically for free, so I'm going to take a chance on something that I might not be willing to spend the $10 for, and suddenly somebody's off seeing Lady Bird or The Shape of Water.
It's like when we saw Mary and the Witch's Flower.
Yes.
We would not have taken a chance on that had we not had MoviePass.
I might have, but
I wouldn't have paid for the Fathom.
Oh, that's right. It was a Fathom event.
It was a Fathom event. Yeah.
Wait, if it was a Fathom event. No. It was a Fathom event first, and then it was like a regular week, a regular release for a week.
Yeah.
And that's when you and I caught up with that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that probably would have been something I would have caught up with eventually, but maybe not in the theater. Or if I did do it in the theater, it would have been at a matinee at best.
Yeah.
I think I'm kind of straight here from what I meant to say about Spielberg. So, I understand, you know, again, there's that, you know, like I said, that push-pull tension between theatrical releasing of content and streaming content, as opposed to theatrical versus television. Spielberg's kind of old guard. He, you know, in the 70s, even though he did start off in TV, TV was kind of looked down on. It was kind of like second tier. You want to be in Hollywood making movies.
Yeah.
And if you're making TV, you're doing okay, but you're not making movies. So
don't do that a third time.
I'm not.
Good.
things have evolved, but I don't want to call Steven Spielberg an old man, but I think he's kind of like a little set in his ways from when he was coming up. And that's fine. You know, we see that all the time, you know, where people kind of calcify into a certain mindset after a certain point. Mm-hmm. I just think, you know, it does a disservice to some of the stuff that Netflix picks up and distributes that maybe they only give a week or two out in the theaters in a couple of key locations before premiering it on their service, because, you know, a lot of the stuff they pick up at Sundance or at other festivals is stuff that was independently produced. You know, the producers and the directors and the cast and everything are like, we hope this movie is so good, a film distributor buys it. And we want a couple of film distributors to come after us, so we have our choice there as to who we go with and who's going to do the best for our film, who's going to get it out in the most theaters, who's going to get that film out in front of the most people for us. Sometimes that's Netflix. So you can't suddenly say that although they were looking for distribution, maybe through Fox Searchlight or A24 or somebody else, Netflix comes in and goes, we're going to give you a bucket load of money for this, and thank you very much. Here's our movie. And then they show it in New York for 1 week, and then they put it on Netflix. You can't call that a TV movie, I don't think.
Perhaps not. But I do have to ask you a question. How many Netflix original films have you watched in the past year?
That Netflix commissioned or that Netflix bought?
Let's do both.
Okay. In terms of films that Netflix has bought from various festivals.
I meant grand total, but okay.
Okay. Oh, I was going to say probably a handful. I know The Polka King was a film that was shot, you know, with the intention of theatrical distribution. It was purchased by Netflix, and it went straight to the service. It didn't even get any kind of precursor theatrical screenings.
We both watched
Cloverfield Paradox. Yes. Cloverfield Paradox, again, was produced by an entirely different company as a theatrical film, and they lost their faith in that, rightfully so, perhaps. Yes. And, you know, they sold it off to Netflix. Netflix had a stunt premiere of it, you know, by saying, hey, right after the Super Bowl, this is going to be on. And they announced that during the Super Bowl, and people went, what? That also didn't get any theatrical screening. But I would say, you know, I wouldn't definitely call that a TV movie. I'd just call it a bad movie. I would say I've only seen like one or two things that Netflix has commissioned themselves as a movie.
So grand total, what, six, seven?
Six or seven.
I've seen three. Now, how many of those per month do you think Netflix puts out?
Wow.
Ballpark a figure. Doesn't have to be.
10? Maybe. Honestly, I'm not sure because I see so much, you know, being announced, and Netflix has, you know, they're going to put 700, you know, new properties, basically, TV shows, comedy specials, and movies.
We can't find the ones that we want to see now.
I know, but if they're dumping 700 new titles into their thing every year, and you're going to literally spend every day watching two things, and that includes, okay, I'm going to watch all of Jessica Jones and some other TV and some other movie now.
It's impossible to get through all of that material.
I don't think you'd want to, though. I think there's a lot of stuff that Netflix will drop in there that you'll be just, don't care about. But somebody else who's a Netflix subscriber does care about, and both of you have an interest in something, a third thing. And that's kind of what they are. They're not a narrow caster or a narrow service like Comedy Central obviously only gives you comedy as a comedy cable channel. There's a streaming service called Brown Sugar. It's all blaxploitation films. I was subscribed to it for a couple of months, but that's so limited. No, yeah, it's all blaxploitation films like Shaft, you know, anything with...
I didn't see that coming.
Fred Williamson and stuff like that. Oh, I love blaxploitation flicks.
No. I meant that there was a streaming service just for that.
Oh, yeah. It's great. You know.
I'm a subscriber to Filmstruck.
Mm-hmm, which is great because... And that's Criterion Collection and older stuff that is also on Turner Classics. You know, there's a lot of like these narrow casting streaming services and they're great. And, you know, you can subscribe for a couple of months and then when you kind of exhaust their catalog or kind of go through and go, okay, I think I'm good here. You can cancel your subscription. Netflix is just like, we've got everything for everybody. They are the puppy that wants to run around at the party and just see everybody go, hi, we got stuff. Oh, here, you like comedy? We got some comedy. You like documentaries? We got documentaries. Hey, we got TV shows and some of them are documentary and some of them are comedy and some of them are comedy documentaries, you know, and it's just crazy how Netflix is, you know, in terms of the breadth of what they offer. I'm sorry.
I have to easily say it's funnier seeing it than it is just hearing it.
Oh, thank you.
But moving on from that.
But Netflix has a lot of content. They're going to commission some of it, like the Will Smith movie Bright back in December, which was terrible, but it was something they commissioned. But they also put it out in the theaters for a couple of weeks in a couple of locations. So is it a TV movie? Is it a regular movie? It's hard to decide, and I certainly don't see the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences going ahead and suddenly doing a drastic overhaul of their definitions of eligibility for Oscars.
No, not now.
Maybe in the future they might, but not now. Again, you know, I'm kind of all over the field on this because there's so many different specific examples of why Spielberg's blanket statement is wrong and why Spielberg's blanket statement is correct. That it's, you know, it's
we could debate
to,
it. Yeah. All day.
And of course, speaking of Jack Black, he's going to be featured in one of the trailers that we'll be looking at in just a moment.
Professionals at this point. Professional. We are professional.
It's a new dawn. It's a new day. It's a new life. It's a new life for me.
Oh my God, I killed someone! I killed someone! Stop yelling them!
And that was a few moments from The Spy Who Dumped Me trailer. The first trailer for this new comedy featuring Kate McKinnon and Mila Kunis. And
Sam Heughan of Outlander, aka Jamie Fraser.
I'm guessing you're an Outlander fan. Okay, moving on from that. What are your thoughts about the trailer?
Okay, I tried watching the trailer once before.
Okay,
I shut it off about 10-15 seconds into it.
While they're still doing the Casino Royale riff?
No, actually. Do you know how to drive a stick?
So you weren't too enamored with that?
No, I wasn't.
It does look like an easy joke.
Yeah. And then halfway through, I saw Jamie and I went, oh, crap. Now I do have to go see it.
Okay. Anything else about the trailer outside of that has you interested in this film?
It looks stupid, to be honest, but it's Kate McKinnon. Kate McKinnon's a lot of fun.
True.
I
probably the brightest spot in the Ghostbusters remake.
Oh, yes. She was a scene stealer.
With Chris Hemsworth being a very close second. Okay.
Leslie.
Yeah, she was good, too. Leslie Jones was awesome. There's a lot to like in that Ghostbusters film that I think did not get a fair shake. It's not a great film. It's not a patch on the original, but there's still some good stuff in there.
And it kind of makes it its own.
Yeah.
It's a lot of fun. There's a reason I bought it.
Ditto.
I'm not the biggest fan of Mila. I feel that her work has been subpar over the past few years.
Hmm.
But it seems like it's going to be a fun time. And did I see Justin Theroux at one point in the trailer?
I believe that was him, yes.
Yeah. An actress from the latest Pacific Rim Uprising film made a small appearance at the end of it. So I would say that we have a decent cast. Sam and Ewan.
Gotcha. My thought is we've already done, a female-centric spy comedy with
Spy.
And Melissa McCarthy, also Ghostbusters. So, does this add anything new by making it two and making them, one of them being the ex-girlfriend of a spy? I mean, it's a different idea playing in that same sandbox, but with a different idea, which I kind of like.
The different idea is that Spy was a woman who worked in the business. She knew the business. She just didn't look like your typical spy. Whereas this, they're not spies.
So there's a competency level here that in Spy that we are not going to see with these two.
Yeah, you're saying. These are just two civilians that just happen to get in the way.
Mm-hmm.
They are collateral damage normally.
True. I mean, again, I like the premise. The spy who dumped me is, it's a fun play on the spy who loved me, obviously. But I also thought, before actually the movie came out that my super ex-girlfriend could be fun, too, because it's about a guy who dated a superhero and then dumped her and she went berserk on him.
That was a horrible film.
But yeah, it was. It was a very, very terrible film. It was a fun premise that went south really fast, unfortunately.
Props to Eddie Izzard, though.
Yes. So hopefully we won't have that problem here, though.
Yes.
Okay. But moving on, what's the next trailer that we're going to be taking a look at?
To be honest, I have no idea what it's about, but it stars Margot Robbie, Simon Pegg, and Mike Myers. So let's hope it's going to be good. This is Terminal.
Bless me, Father, for I have sinned.
Okay, what do you want? You want money? Say whatever you want.
Oh, well, that is a very poor choice of words.
I am Mr. Franklin. I have an offer. I want you to kill someone for me.
Black briefcase in a locker. That is a job for Mr. Franklin. This is massive.
No trains till tomorrow. 404 going north.
404 is an age away. It's not time that I'm trying to kill.
Want my advice?
Not really.
Just end it. I'll set them on one another like starving rats in a cage, and you can watch through the bars.
Bang.
What was that? I don't even know what to say about that, except for Max Irons.
I'm processing that, too. Literally, we have just watched this trailer, and I'm stunned by
the visuals.
The visuals. Visually, it looks amazing. I love the bright, contrasty colors. Feels a little Dario Argento-ish there.
It also feels very, maybe a bit neo-noir.
Some
neo-noir, definitely in the stylization of her clothes and her hair and the way she carries herself. She's obviously going for femme fatale.
Again, it's a very highly stylized overall production.
Yeah.
Production designed out the wazoo. the camera work that we see in the trailer, and granted, this is, you know, just snippets of probably longer shots, looks very, very stylized as well. A lot of stuff seems very centered and symmetrical, almost like Wes Anderson, if Wes Anderson produced some kind of like crazy, it's like Wes Anderson, Tarantino, and Dario Argento were tossed into a blender. And this movie was poured out.
That is an apt description.
And quite honestly, just that description myself, I want to see this.
I need to see this.
It could be a giant, horrible pile of garbage, but right now they've got the hook. They've got the hook in me. I really want to see this. I'm intrigued. I'm not a fan of that scraggly beard on Simon Pegg, but other than that.
Speaking of Simon Pegg, he will mm-hmm. be in a film that we'll be talking about soon.
Yes, in just a few moments. Yes. But one more trailer we have to get through first, and that is the first preview we've seen for...
The House with a Clock in Its Walls.
Ticking.
Hello, you're Lewis, I presume.
You'll see. Things are quite different here. Is a very old place. There's a clock in the walls.
Do you hear the ticking? Ticking, ticking, ticking.
We don't know what it does, except something horrible.
So, you've told Lewis everything?
Well, not everything.
And that is the first trailer for The House with a Clock in Its Walls, or as I like to call it, 1940s Goosebumps.
Yes. Okay. Okay. I'm not the only one going, Jack Black is just kind of just going to segue into doing kids' scary movies now? That's fine. That's good.
Yeah, but you've got Cate Blanchett.
True. True. But I think Jack Black lends an air of he can be kind of menacing, but he's also kind of a cuddly teddy bear and a little funny. So he undercuts that menace himself.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, I'm not familiar with the original children's book that this is based on.
Oh, it is based on a children's book?
Yeah. But it looks like it could be a lot of fun.
It's actually being written by the creator of the Supernatural TV series, Eric Kripke.
Okay.
In fact, I have a tweet here or a quote that he sent out on the day of the trailer's release. When I was 10, I fell in love with this book. The only fan letter I ever wrote was to its author. Mm-hmm. It's one of the main inspirations for Supernatural. Now we got to make it into a movie. Dreams come true.
Well, that's great. Hopefully it will be good then. I'm sure, you know, if you've been a fan of the material for all those years, you know it inside out. He certainly, you know, knows how to make a successful TV series, because Supernatural has been on the air now for 30, 45 years now? Something like that?
I think 18, if I'm not mistaken. And it is one of the last surviving remnants of the WB.
That's
so hush.
True. I know. I know. Also, hey, I like Eric Kripke's Timeless on NBC, which just returned for its second season.
Go ahead. I'll give you a pass. Mention who's in the film that you're excited for.
Kyle MacLachlan. I'm sorry, I'm still riding a Twin Peaks high from last year.
Why am I not surprised?
Hey, because it took 26 years to be able to get that high. So I'm holding on to it as long as I can for a while, because I don't think we're going to get another return to that lovely, lovely logging town out in the Pacific Northwest.
Well, speaking of going back to an older time and nostalgia.
Oh, nice segue.
Thank you. We'll be back in a few moments with our review of Ready Player One.
This is the Oasis. It's a place where the limits of reality are your own imagination. People come to the Oasis for all the things they can do, but they stay because of all the things they can be. I'm here talking to all of you now because our future is being threatened. I just came here to escape. But I found something much bigger than myself. I found my friends.
What up, Z?
I found love. And now, people have lost their lives.
No.
This is war. We're in control of the future.
Find him.
Welcome to the Rebellion, Wade.
2011 saw the publication of Ernest Cline's debut novel, Ready Player One. A big sloppy wet kiss to 1980s video games and nerd culture, the film tells the story of Wade Watts, a young man from 2045 Columbus, Ohio, who is navigating a massively popular online game / social network called The Oasis in order to find three special keys hidden by the game's co-creator, James Halliday. The one who finds all three keys will inherit Halliday's fortune valued at around $500 billion and control of the Oasis. So not unexpectedly, the competition to find the three keys is pretty intense. In the Oasis, players can take on the aspect of anyone or anything they want, which frequently means they will cloak themselves to look like something from one of their favorite films or video games. And since Halliday was a fan of 1980s pop culture, so too are many of the players. It seems appropriate, then, that director Steven Spielberg is the one to bring the book to the big screen. The 1980s were a pretty significant decade for Steven Spielberg, and much like he did for Who Framed Roger Rabbit, which he produced, Spielberg is able to leverage his position in Hollywood to bring many of the intellectual properties from other studios referenced in the book into the film. Rich.
Yes.
As someone who proudly states that they came into their nerddom in the 1980s,
yes.
Did you find the movie's use of 80s nostalgia fun or a cynical co-opting of your teen years?
Well, actually a bit of both, I'll admit, and I'm kind of all over on this movie. There are things about it I liked, things about it I didn't like. But first, I think the key to really following the movie itself is disengage your brain from trying to play Where's Waldo with the movie and stop trying to find like all the little hidden pop culture things that are fill the screen. There's so much to the foreground.
There is so many.
Film. Yeah.
If it's
distracting.
Yeah. If it pops out at you and you go, oh, yeah, it's big enough that you can't miss it, then sure, call it out, but don't spend your time actively searching for it because your brain will actually hurt.
Yeah, yes. I mean, it's fun to sit there and go, oh, there's the house from The Wizard of Oz spinning through that that hurricane thing.
Wait, that was a thing? I didn't see it.
That was like in the first minute of the film.
Really?
Yes.
I feel like a...
That's okay.
Goof, goof.
But you know, don't sit there and start looking at the screen for other things, like at the expense of paying attention to what the characters are doing. I'm thinking particularly of one character has a workshop in the Oasis where they're building, you know, they build and repair things for other people. And in the background, if you look deep into the background, you can see, oh, there's a Viper from Battlestar Galactica there. Oh, there's the pod from 2001. What's that other ship there? I can't quite make it out. And you start to get distracted by that stuff going on in the background that you miss what the hell the characters are saying in the foreground.
And I didn't have a problem with that because I didn't even catch those.
Okay. Well, that's good because you need to actively kind of disengage from trying to do that at times.
but there's so much pop culture reference overload. It's ridiculous. And a lot of it doesn't add anything to the movie. They could say, oh, you know, you could see like, you know, at one point you see like the spaceship from Firefly or the movie Serenity flying around.
Wait, what? Where?
It's in the end battle.
I must have just not been paying attention.
Okay, you are really not helping me sell my point here. I want you to know.
Sorry. Actually, the one I was really hoping for that we got a slight glimpse of in the trailer was Tracer. So, yes, I am about ready to back up your point.
Okay. But what I'm saying is, okay, it's great. It's cool. We see the Firefly show. He's like, yeah, I love that thing. But why is it here? Does its use comment on that? Or does all this use of nostalgic things comment on the idea of nostalgia at all? And I don't think the movie does that. I mean, it's a fun adventure. You've got it's a better video game movie or a movie about video games than actual video game movies that we have seen. Tomb Raider. And
Oi.
I'm not hating on Tomb Raider. You know, we both, I think, agreed it was kind of a mixed bag of a film. And this is also, for me at least, a mixed bag of a film. But it does it
we
better.
We can't be friends anymore.
Oh. No, I think Spielberg, you know, certainly shows that he still has the chops to mount some exciting action sequences. And a lot of this movie is pure CG. A lot of it is.
Oh,
so that's really kind of like taking any residual chains and leashes off of Spielberg to just run rampant with the technology and, you know, with his virtual camera through this world. And that's exciting to see. But honestly, I thought some of the characters were paper thin. And the lead hero, Percival, basically he's in the game to win money and he doesn't seem to really learn anything as he goes through the stages of the game that we see. And at the end, you know, it's as you said off mic, it's kind of like the end to Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, and where he's offered an everlasting gobstopper. And he has to make that choice. And that's really the only real choice he kind of makes or any kind of moral quandary he has in this whole thing. You know, he just kind of fumbles along through this whole story because he's a gamer and he plays games and that's what he does. And that's it for me. You know, that's how I felt about this thing. I've seen it twice now and I'm like, I still don't know too much about this character.
I sort of get him.
Okay.
But the problem is, and I respect Ernest Cline for actually adapting his own book into the screenplay, but it is missing some very important details. When they say everything is done in the Oasis, they mean it. His schooling, and this is where they actually mixed it up, he goes to school in the Oasis.
Okay, is that's a detail from the book?
Yeah.
Okay, that would have been interesting.
Because we actually saw the students watching James Halliday's video in real time.
Okay.
I thought
that was actually him in, I thought those were actual students in reality, not in the virtual reality.
No, that was reality.
Okay.
But.
Oh, okay.
In the book version, he transfers into his avatar and goes to school inside the Oasis. They do everything inside the Oasis. So when they say they're plugged in, they mean it.
Mm-hmm.
Everything is done there.
And there's certain downsides to, you know, that technology. And you can certainly draw a parallel to, like, Facebook. Because there's one funny, smart, sarcastic, cynical, satirical moment in the early part of the film where the film's nominal bad guy who's a businessman, is talking about, hey, if we gain control of the Oasis, we've discovered we can deliver so many ads to these people. 80%, we can put up to 80% of their field of vision covered in ads before people would have a seizure. Which is funny because they're like, we'd give them more, but apparently that might hurt them. So. Yeah, we could get in trouble for that. There was no caring about the fact that they're giving people, could give people seizures. It's more of the fact, like, we could probably get in trouble for giving people seizures, which was a nice touch. The other nice touch about that character played by Ben Mendelsohn is
And I don't know if it was on purpose or not, but given how nostalgic oriented everything else in this movie is, his character really just reminded me of the vice principal from Breakfast Club.
Yes. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Okay. It's not just me then.
And he wasn't a vice principal.
Oh, the,
he was
or
just
the teacher.
a teacher. On
what have
detention
you.
Duty. Yeah. Yes. He reminded me so much of that.
The hair, the shape of his face, basically. Yeah. So.
Did he raid, who was it, Rod Stewart's wardrobe or something like that?
So,
which is funny because
his attempt to be hip and sound hip to Percival at one point.
He makes the John Hughes Breakfast Club Ferris Bueller reference.
That's right. He references Shermer High School. So,
yeah. So that,
one of
that
the first cinematic universes.
Wade, I understand. He's a gamer. He does everything in the Oasis. It is his escape from his life, which, to be honest, is pretty crappy.
Yeah.
And for him, it started out as, okay, yeah, this is fun. And should I win, I get to relieve myself of this life that I am in right now, and I don't want it. I don't like it. I don't like how I'm being treated. I mean, at one point, his
parents are dead. He's living with his aunt.
His aunt's boyfriend punches him.
His aunt has a succession of bad boyfriends.
Yeah.
Yeah, and that's weird, too, because that kind of gets into a little spoiler territory there. Beyond that I kind of want to avoid, but something happens there, and you're kind of like mixed emotions about it because you're like, well, but at the same time, yeah, I hate to sound vague about it, but hopefully you'll understand if you see the film that something happens, and it's kind of a good side bad side thing to it, I guess you could say.
Yeah.
But.
The reason why I understand it is at first he just thinks it's for fun. It's a game. It's another means of escape is just finding this key, is escaping not now from reality, but just from his real life situation.
Yes.
But then he's starting to come to terms with this isn't a game anymore. There are people out to get me.
When he succeeds in solving the first challenge, which had gone unsolved for 5 years.
Yeah.
And suddenly that's when it becomes real, because our Ben Mendelsohn character is the head of this company.
Which was a rival.
Yes.
And are trying to take over.
And would love to get control of the Oasis because it's a $1 trillion economic resource in the real world, because so many people play this game that you know, it becomes, you know, some high stakes are there, you know, in terms of who controls this. But at the same time, you know, having economics be the driving motivator for a character is a little thin sauce, I think. It's like, ooh, we've got to save the world's economy. It's, you know, economics didn't work in the first Star Wars movie. I can't think of a movie where economics drove something in terms of like adventure or an action film like that. And it was any good.
Mm. I do like that the film also wrestles with the idea of real life and the virtual reality. I mean, it's becoming very prominent nowadays. VR headsets are the latest thing in gaming technology.
True.
So the fact that this film is coming out at this moment is, I'd say, important.
It could be a precursor, kind of a cautionary tale.
Yes.
If you will, about living your life online versus, you know.
I think that's the lesson he's trying to not just teach Wade, but teach the whole world is, yes, I created this for fun, not to be used as a resource, not to spend your life plugged in to this and not living a life, because when you become old, you are full of regret for the things that you missed out on. And you will miss out on so much. You'll watch your life go by around you, and you'll be in this game.
Okay. That is a great theme that I think is fully explored there. There's a couple of things, though, that kind of tangentially connect to that, that I don't think were fully explored. Specifically, the idea of adopting a new persona when you're inside the game versus who you are outside. Obviously, there's a couple of characters who we do meet in both realms the real world and the virtual world, and there is differences between their appearances. But I don't think they really kind of explored that as much as I would have liked, I think. They don't kind of dig into that meat of, you know, how do you perceive yourself, and that's the image you project once you're in the Oasis versus how you are outside of the Oasis.
It's not a set character.
There's a couple of characters who have different appearances in the Oasis, and I was kind of like, they do sort of mention why one character is like that, and I don't want to get into it any further than that because I don't want to spoil that surprise. But there's another character who also has a difference of appearance, and why that character appears in the Oasis one way and, you know, in a different way than they appear in the real world is not touched upon. And I kind of was wondering, well, why do they do that then? I mean, I can understand why the one character can, but why why is this character appearing differently than they are in reality? And I never kind of got an answer to that. I don't feel there's an answer in the film. And that was like one of many things that left me wondering about the characters who join Wade/Percival on his quest to find all three keys that are needed to win the game.
It's not set. It's not like, okay, this is how I perceive myself or how I want the world, or it's not like it looks into your soul and goes, okay, this is how you should look.
No, I'm not saying the game does that. I'm saying, why does this character present themselves?
This.
Why do they choose to look like this in the game world versus how they look in reality?
I don't think it matters. I don't think it matters because every gamer is different. I know for a fact that as much as I love my black hair and my pale skin, when I'm a gamer, that's not the look that I choose for myself.
Okay.
I've played Overwatch, okay? Mm-hmm. And which goes back to Tracer. And as I'm a big fan, I'm an Anglophile. But Tracer's not going to be the person I choose. I'm pretty good at sniping. I go Widowmaker. Which you probably don't understand.
You've just said
references.
A whole lot of words that sound like English. Yet, I just don't game. So maybe I'm looking at it just from like a film's, you know, characterization standpoint versus, you know, how gamers think about how they approach what kind of avatars they want in the gaming world that they're playing.
But actually, the main character I play on Overwatch is mainly because I'm a relative newbie. I chose the character, and if any of you are gamers, you'll understand this, is Reinhardt Wilhelm. He's a big, hulking German dude with really badass armor. And I mean, he's huge, and he carries this big hammer.
Okay.
And the reason for that is his powers and what he's able to do just work better for me.
Okay.
Because I am a beginner.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, I need to have a lot more force than I need stealth.
Okay. So you're saying it's gamers are choosing online avatars more as a function of how they want to play the game versus a function of expression of themselves?
Well, one of the characters that we see in Ready Player One has the ability to separate his upper body from his lower body.
Yes.
In order to make sure a gunshot goes right through him and doesn't harm him. Is there a possibility that they use that as, I have that ability.
Okay.
Gives me an advantage.
Yeah, I think that's an ability that they have as an advantage, but that character is also a mechanic, and so having that ability to kind of, you know, add your, you know, move your torso up, you know, a foot and a half or 2 feet away from, you know, the lower half of your body probably helps when they're building something or have to reach up to something that they're working on.
And that strength.
So there's
as
a practicality
well.
There. Yeah. And yeah. The strength there. So there's a combination of things, you know, for exercising their skills and for when they're playing in competitions. But there's a part of that character.
Also, as a mechanic, he could also believe in body mod.
That's true. So, yeah. So, you know, I was approaching avatars as a form of character expression, or you know, expression for the characters from the real world, especially because we see Wade slash Percival as he's getting ready for that date, trying on different looks. Should I go full Michael Jackson, you know, Thriller era? Should I go Duran Duran? And finally he chooses, you know, to go dressed as a character from another film. You know, so I'm thinking, you know, maybe that's what sparked that idea in my mind that,
no,
you know,
once you characterize how you want your avatar to look,
mm-hmm.
the outer skin can be changed. Your avatar doesn't change.
Oh, yeah. They talked about modding a lot. Artemis's motorcycle, they said, was a standard motorcycle with a skin of the motorcycle from the great Akira anime film. So, you know, obviously, you know, they kind of talk about that idea pretty early in the film.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I'm familiar with that, but, you know, I'm probably overthinking this, honestly.
You probably are. That, and you need to play a few more video games.
Oh, gosh.
I did love the Minecraft reference right in the beginning.
Oh, Minecraft World?
I lost it laughing. Like, yes.
Yeah, I would play more video games if you guaranteed me I would never have the need to sleep again. Because I pack enough into like a 17, 18 hour day as it is.
And yet I still see more movies than you do.
I know, because I'm doing other things. Like editing podcasts.
Ouch. We're just going to do a roast back and forth for the next 5 minutes.
No,
so bear with us.
No. There are a lot of things, though, I do like in this movie. Like I said before, Spielberg, you know, certainly hasn't lost his touch in mounting an action sequence. And the first challenge, which we see bits of in the trailer, is a manic car race through a changing and malleable New York City to get to Central Park and the finish line.
Doesn't it kind of remind you of Death Race?
A little bit, yeah. A little bit of Death Race on LSD, maybe. Because there's all sorts of obstacles that pop up and come out at the various drivers. I don't want to say too much about what they are, because some of them you haven't seen in the trailer, so they're fun surprises.
At least we know that there are wrecking balls, because we did see
saw the wrecking balls, but I don't want to mention
anything
of the
else.
Adults.
Please don't.
But what's really great about that sequence is we go through it the way all the gamers go through it for the first time. And then once Percival figures out the secret of that challenge and how to defeat it and how to win, we see that challenge again from an entirely different viewpoint. And it is equally as exciting and interesting and funny at that point as it was the first time. And just giving us that two different viewpoints of how that worked was a really neat, fun idea that I liked a lot in this movie.
Yeah, so did I.
Another thing I liked, too, was, and I didn't notice it at first, I noticed it on the second time, the movie starts off with Van Halen's jump, and it's only in the front two stereo channels of the theater. It's not until the picture comes in and the camera starts to move through the world of the Oasis as Percival gives us a voiceover about what the Oasis is and is explaining everything and giving us this giant exposition dump. That's the first 3 minutes of the movie.
Hey.
No, it is. That's what it is. It's just exposition, exposition, exposition.
The first 6 to 7 pages of the book are nothing but exposition from James Halliday himself.
True. True.
So at least they shortened it.
True. But as we start to move through the Oasis, we go from that two-channel stereo to full surround.
I didn't catch on that.
Which, in the 80s, we just basically had two-channel stereo for our movies, and then as movies progressed to where we are now, we got that full surround. So I think even just that brief couple of moments there of jump at the beginning, it was kind of like here's a throwback to how movies used to sound in the 80s. It was a nice little touch, and I was like, oh, yeah. And it just, you know, it just kind of made me smile that kind of attention to detail, that kind of observation to detail is present in this movie.
Looks like I'll be seeing it again this week.
The one thing, though, that I didn't like was...
Oh, there's only one?
Well... Besides the other ones I've already mentioned, there was one thing that really bothered me, and I was kind of surprised by this, because this was something that could have been fixed in the script stage, this could have been fixed in editing. There's a lot of times that they could have fixed this, And it's just that exposition is repeated many times. It's not just like one person says something or there's a lot of exposition because this is a big, giant new world that we have to explain to audiences. But the same point of exposition is repeated two or three times by two or three different characters in two or three different locations to a point where it's just like, yeah, we get it. We know that this is this and this and this and this is why. And it's especially grievous in the movie's third act when they get to the final challenge and the key to solving that final challenge. They repeat a certain specific line about something. And again, I'm trying to keep this semi-spoiler free here. Three different characters in three different locations say the exact same thing. And it's like, we get it. You don't have to keep repeating that. The audience, we understand and we remember it from just 2 minutes ago when the last person said it. That was something I thought was really kind of sloppy in the filmmaking. I was really surprised by that.
Now that I think back on it, yeah, you're right. But I guess that just goes to show how much I didn't care.
Fair enough.
Is that I didn't even really remember it until you said something about it.
Okay, maybe.
Sorry, completely shot your...
Maybe you don't remember from 2 minutes earlier when somebody said it then.
No, I do. I do, and I probably did back then, mm-hmm. but it just didn't bother me.
Okay.
I mean, it wasn't like when I was sitting watching the first Pacific Rim and four times within the same fight, he goes, let's finish this. He said those exact words.
I know. No, I know exactly what you mean there, too.
Whereas this, I think, was done a little different, and therefore it didn't bother me as much.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they were trying to get the same point across many times. But at least they weren't using the same wording over and over.
Just about, it felt like. But beyond that, you know, you said this is probably one that's going to land in your Blu-ray collection.
Yes.
For me, maybe if I see it on sale, I would buy it.
Ouch.
But it's not a burning priority.
I'm also buying the soundtrack.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, there's a lot of great 80s tunes in there. So I would suggest, buy that, you know, because there's a lot of fun new wave songs. Yay. But,
new wave.
Oh, come on. don't be like that. But for me, this is certainly not among Spielberg's best. It's not among his worst. It's kind of middle of the road Spielberg, which is still better than a lot of other directors' best work. So, you know, I would definitely recommend go seeing it on the big screen, especially if you do enjoy a lot of the stuff that the movie references. Just don't be looking for the references at the expense of
the story
itself. Watch the story first, and then if you liked it enough, go back, watch it again, and then go, oh, okay, there's the thing, and there's the other thing, and that's the reference to that. So,
and I think that just about wraps us up for this week, doesn't it?
Pretty much. So remember, you can find us online at bigpicturepod.com, and we are now available on iTunes. So either use the link in the show notes or head directly over there, search, and hit subscribe. And if you like what you're hearing, leave a positive review because that always helps us connect with new listeners.
We'll be back next week with more film news analysis.
And that's on the Big Picture Podcast.